Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible, because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, I'm Tobias Carlyle. This is the Acquirers Podcast. My special guests today are Max Frumas and Sujeet Indup. We're talking about their brand new book, The Caesar's Palace Coup. If you enjoyed Barbarians at the Gate, this is sort of the sequel. This is what happens when big buyouts go bad. They'll be talking us through the bankruptcy process and the big players who are in here. It's an absolutely fascinating discussion. It's coming up right after this.
Tobias Carlyle is the founder and principal of Acquirers Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquirers Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquirers Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquirersfunds.com.
What was the Caesar's Palace coup?
The coup part of it was really the entire Caesar's Entertainment company that had, I guess it was overloaded with debt from a buyout back in at the top of the market pre Great Financial Crisis, started in 2006 and they barely closed it in 2008, and then because it had so much debt, it had to eventually, after a lot of different machinations, file for bankruptcy in 2015, and there was just this giant war over the entity that filed for bankruptcy, which included Caesar's Palace. So it was very appropriate. But there's dozens and dozens of casinos and a huge amount of money and businesses that are wrapped up in the entire company. And you had creditors that were fighting with the private equity companies that bought it out in 2008, Apollo and TPG. And so, really the coup portion of it was that these creditors, they were able to ultimately prevail and take control of a large portion of the company through a Chapter 11 process. Even though the private equity owners did everything that they possibly could and probably more than they probably should have, to maintain ownership and as much control of different assets as they could.
So it went through some sort of bankruptcy. Whoever the private equity owners were, was it TPG and Apollo?
That's right.
And it fell to bankruptcy just because paid way too much at the very top of the market, totally loaded with debt. Then it goes into this bankruptcy process, which is, folks might not know, but there are lots of investors out there who focus solely on this part of the process, and they use it as a means to get control of the entity. So can you talk us through how did it all play out?
I'll start with distressed debt investing. And then I guess Sujeet will get into the process, but distressed debt investing world involves a lot of very sophisticated hedge funds that buy up debt of companies that might be trading at a large discount, pennies on the dollar, because the company is in financial trouble or some sort of distress. And in this case, they'd purchased a lot of the Caesar Entertainment debt. And then sometimes they recover that through a Chapter 11. Sometimes they recover that because the company recovers or some other type of deal is struck out of court. In this case, it went through the Chapter 11 process. Sujeet can add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the simplest way to think of this is bankruptcy really has become a place for entrepreneurship in America, where you can buy a company and you get the chance, if you want to put real money after it, to reset its capital structure, reset its operations, a way to get a ready-made business. And so the smartest investors in the world are thinking, rather than buying a company that's healthy, we can buy a company, we can make money that way.
And so who are the players in the through that process?
Yeah, and so certainly the private equity firms here were Apollo and TPG, two very well-known firms, real pioneers in this in the world of buyouts. And we spend the first part of the book going through the history of these firms and where they came from, how they really seized the marketplace in the early 90s. TPG is very famous for its initial origin trade was buying Continental Airlines out of bankruptcy and making a fortune. Apollo had come out of Drexel, the famed junk bond bank of the 80s that had problems over Michael Milken scandals, but then was some of its key executives were reborn in Apollo. And then you have these hedge funds, which are firms that are not have some similarities with private equity firms, but they really specialize in buying and trading securities and being very savvy about the legal process. And also, again, when you buy a security, when do you sell it? And so those firms are like Elliott, which is the firm founded by Paul Singer, who's most famous for their fight with Argentina, which went on for more than a decade, and they seized a ship very famously. Elliott's an important player. Appaloosa's another important player, a guy named David Tepper, who was a famous trader at Goldman Sachs, fell out there, started Appaloosa, and made a series of really smart trades. And I think he's probably the single richest person in the story. He's probably worth $20 million. And after this case, he buys the Carolina Panthers football team for a record price. We think his victory in Caesars and that purchase of the football team are related things. And then you've got firms like Oaktree, which is another important kind of distressed debt pioneer. Howard Marks is the founder of that firm, co-founder. He writes the famous memos that come out, and he's this like market sage. And so you really have the biggest players in the world on Wall Street in this case. A lot of business stories, which are good, often have B and C list players. We actually have a story that's an A-list story with A-list play story.
Yeah, so some very big players, very big egos, very sharp elbows in there. So what was the basis for Apollo and TPG? They were trying to defend the equity, but what was their sort of basis for, you know, staying in there and arguing that the equity had some value?
Yeah, so yeah, we have an anecdote in the book about Blackstone, which had similarly bought Hilton Hotels right before the financial crisis, and they did a restructuring, and ultimately Blackstone made $14 billion in Hilton when it seemed like it was going to go bankrupt. And so it's the same kind of thesis here. I mean, they believe in this business, Caesars. They think it's cyclical and it's going to snap back. They just have to keep it alive for long enough and keep Elliott and Oaktree and Appaloosa at bay. And if they do that, they're going to make billions of dollars. And so the story is about that process and how that went wrong. Max, you were going to say?
I would say like one of the, one of the premises that all of the distressed investments were based on as well were that just it doing, you know, valuation by people who understood gaming and they understood the value of these casinos. There's $18 billion in debt at the operating company at the time that this ultimately filed for bankruptcy. And distressed debt investors, they did this calculation between what they felt the value of that entire entity should be and where the collective debt was trading. And there was just a huge discount already. Tranche of debt they felt was undervalued. There were different arguments for different tranches of debts, but everybody believed that the intrinsic value of the of the entire entity was undervalued. Apollo thought that, yeah, it just needed to snap back and they would be able to recover something if they could maintain control. All the creditors thought the same thing. And, you know, ultimately they had, you know, they had rights as creditors to force the hand of the owners. But everyone really did agree that the business would snap back eventually and be very valuable, which it was.
So the whole enterprise is valuable, but the problem that they have is they have some sort of liquidity issue where they just can't meet the debts as and when they fall due, they breach the covenants, and that's what triggers all of this. Is there any suggestion that the purchases of the debt might have aided that process along?
Absolutely. they would proudly say that that was the case. To say that this is a liquidity problem, right, is like being in a, you know, a ship that's vertical going down and saying, I think we got a little bit of water that's coming on board. The company was, you know, 2 years prior to it filing for bankruptcy. it was clearly not going to be able to service several billion dollars of interest payments. And at that point, you know, they started doing these different transactions that shifted valuable assets out of the operating company. And while it solved it solved the problem temporarily by getting some additional cash into the operating company, it took away revenue and EBITDA, right? And so all the things that they were saying, you know, that they were doing to try to stave off this liquidity shortfall, just wound up exacerbating it, and it brought the day of reckoning that all the creditors want. And the creditors, they were like, they got to stop taking these assets. This is super aggressive. And so among many things that they did to force their hand, besides, you know, filing a couple different lawsuits about the transactions themselves, was Elliott Management was behind a lawsuit to try to appoint essentially a conservator to put, you know, Caesars into the hand of someone who would take away from Apollo. And so they filed this very aggressive lawsuit previously. It was one of the many things that forced Apollo and TPG to come to the table and come up with some sort of agreement to file it at a certain date with at least one class of creditors on board. The creditors, they did a number of things to force the issue. And ultimately, you know, Apollo and TPG didn't have much of a choice.
Must be a little bit nerve-wracking sitting on the other side of the table from Singer, because they are one of the few funds that has gone out there and actually foreclosed on a sovereign, which you don't see often. It's often that they're going after big businesses, but a sovereign is an entire, and I think it wasn't, I thought it was a naval ship, but I don't think it was actually naval, the ship that they actually foreclosed on. But do you discuss that story?
We have that story in the background to Elliott. And I think what's interesting about this case is, in my opinion, there's like two firms that really, really matter that tower over the rest of the industry in distressed debt investing. And one is Elliott. They just have deep principles. They have deep pockets. They do a lot of work, and they take huge stakes and take very aggressive positions. And they stick to their guns, literally, or figuratively. And then Appaloosa the same way. Again, both take big stakes, have very kind of charismatic owners, and they just strike fear in the heart of everyone else because they can just take such large stakes. And when they have a conviction about something, they just don't back up, which is what happened here with both Elliott and Appaloosa. Like, Apollo's also a titanic figure in this world, and people are afraid of them. But Elliott and Appaloosa are truly the two firms in the world that are capable of standing up to Apollo, and that's what the story is largely about.
Well, even Apollo is a frightening prospect too, because Leon Black's had that very long history with Drexel Burnham, and then Leon Black, who's the maybe now former leader of of Apollo. But
well, and that's a big part of the story, and that there is this pressure and intimidation campaign that Apollo sets forth against various creditors, and it works most of the time. People are afraid of standing up to these guys and getting in their way, and it affects their ability to do business down the road. There's another important firm called Canyon, which is very aggressive at first, but then starts to feel the heat a little bit and backs off. And Oaktree, also a very formidable firm, gets nervous because they're standing there alone. And very dramatically, I hope we tell them the story, that Appaloosa shows up. So it is this real clash of the titans and this clash of egos. And we hope in this story, like the suspense is who is going to blink first, who's going to back down, because these firms are not used to anyone telling them what they can and can't do.
Yeah, certainly no shrinking violets among that group. What's your background? Do you guys come from, or are you reporters, or are you finance guys? Or how did you come together and find this story?
Got one of each. My background is is a journal, long time financial journalist. When I came to New York about 11 years ago on a private equity beat with the deal. And then gravitated towards the debt that was put on to all these private equity deals, then to distressed debt specifically, and then I helped start up a company specifically dedicated to putting out stories and technical coverage of distressed debt investing and restructuring. And all of our clients were actually hedge funds and a lot of the people that were involved. Very, very niche technical business journalist by background. But Sajid has, he's the bona fides as a businessman prior to his, rebirth as a journalist.
Yeah, so by way of background, I've been at the FT for 8 years now. But before that, I was an investment banker for many years. I've been an analyst at an investment bank after college. I later went to business school and then was a specialist in M&A. And I was not a distressed or a bankruptcy banker, but Caesars to me, when I started covering it, was really an interesting corporate finance story. There was these interesting transactions that Apollo was doing, and that ultimately turned into the bankruptcy. And then I covered the second part of the bankruptcy for the FT, not on a day-to-day basis, but like the big moments. And so Max and I, both at the end of this case, we were both covering it at very different publications and from a different point of view, but we knew this story was gold. I mean, it had all these incredible players. The drama was very dramatic. There was a lot of twists and turns, and there hadn't been a book about distress in Chapter 11 and restructuring many years ago. Obviously, Barbarians at the Gate was written, and that was a book about the buyout industry. I like to think of this book as like the second half of that, or the sequel in some sense, and that this is what happens when a private equity deal goes bad. And so Max and I, very fortuitously, by dumb luck, ended up meeting on social media. I had been interested in the book. He had already started work on a book, and we compared notes, and we knew it was a complicated story that could use two experienced journalists from different backgrounds. And so that's how we came together. It took a while to sell the book. It's actually pretty hard to sell a book as a first-time writer, particularly on a complicated subject. But we found a publisher and told the story, and the pandemic happened, and all these twists and turns on our own journeys. But here we are.
Did you write the book during the pandemic, or were you done by the time that all came around?
Yeah, unfortunately,
the core reporting was in 2019.
Yeah, we did the in-person interviews, flying around.
And then last year was editing it. So last year was a good year to be editing a book.
Let's talk a little bit about high-profile Chapter 11s. What are these Neiman, Toys R Us, PG&E, and Hertz? What do they tell us about this particular case?
Yeah, I think that what we like to say is that all of the factors that created the modern day Chapter 11 process and all the kind of like the interesting innovations simplified by the Caesars case, and then every subsequent bankruptcy also can be referenced in some way, shape, or form to the Caesars case. Modern day Chapter 11 was born out of the rewriting of the bankruptcy code in 1978. Which essentially allowed for different creditor classes. You know, before there was maybe just a couple of different banks. They were all just assumed to be kind of one. Have one idea. They get some sort of recovery, and there wasn't as much representation between, let's say, first, second lien, unsecureds. That might have, different priorities. And so, once that happened, and along with the proliferation of junk bonds, it created these just enormous capital structures at companies that would then need to restructure. And the Chapter 11 process in the U.S. became kind of the model for the world. And that created a very sophisticated type of distressed debt investor found a major foothold after the Great Financial Crisis as well. Major fortunes were made from that because the understanding of investing in undervalued securities. That's where David Tepper made a lot of his money. By the time this case was taking place, it was a very, very competitive industry where a lot of people had made a lot of money. If there was a real good opportunity to get involved with a good company that had a bad balance sheet, then there would be a pretty vicious fight over, who got control of it and who would be able to make the disproportionate amount of money. For around this time, major bankruptcies that happened that were the result of the top of the buyout, like the 2006, 2007 buyout boom, that era included, TXU, you got, Caesars, there's five or six other examples of companies that had 20, $30 billion buyouts that eventually filed for bankruptcy. Those all happened within a couple of years of each other. And then after Caesars, you had cases like J. Crew and Neiman Marcus, where in a similar fashion, there was what we call the stripping of assets, which is away from creditors, which was because of these loopholes in the credit agreements and the indentures that govern the bonds and the loans of these companies. The private equity sponsor can, through how loose they are, move assets that should have actually provided credit support to those creditors away from them, and then give them some sort of negotiating leverage in a bankruptcy or a restructuring situation. And so we've seen a lot of those in the bankruptcies post Caesars or even out of court restructurings. We see that, and then we also see a lot of the players from Caesars doing similar things in bankruptcies nowadays. A recent one I can think of is like Acosta was this company that Oaktree and Elliott, they wound up buying the debt and completely equitizing it, owning the company, and then having it emerge debt free. We see a lot of the culmination of everything prior to Caesars showing up in Caesars, and then everything subsequently is kind of people have learned some lessons to then apply in these subsequent Chapter 11s.
It seems to be a feature of distressed debt investing that as the market gets more and more expensive and people pay more and more for these businesses, higher multiples, lower sort of possibility of them paying it back, that the loans tend to become less the fewer covenants, less protection on the downside. And for whatever reason, everybody seems to be so eager to buy this debt that they're able to get it through. So they call them covenant light. What is a covenant light loan, and how does that feature in this story?
Yeah, I guess since I work, you know, I work at Fitch right now that owns Covenant Review, and I work closely with the Covenant Review guys, which is a great patient or great product that 24 LevFin attorneys just pouring over hundreds of pages of credit documents. Covenant light means that essentially there's nothing that a company there's no ratios that a company has to maintain in order to keep on the good side of the creditors, right? So there's nothing if they stop making any money whatsoever, it's not going to go below a certain debt to EBITDA ratio, or there's lots of different ratios that would normally be maintenance covenants. Like you have to be making X amount of money, you have to be making X amount of revenue compared with your earnings. Otherwise, the creditors have the right to accelerate and force your payment. In the past, this is normally what you negotiate as a creditor. As CLO funds and high yield bond funds proliferated, and there's just so much money sloshing around looking to buy leveraged loans and bonds, the creditors had no more negotiating room, because if they didn't put money into this deal, then somebody else would. And so the companies and the private equity firms, they're smart to this, and they'd be like, all right, sure, but we're not going to put in any covenants that would force us to turn over the keys or pay you back or pay you a fee if there are some dramatic changes in our business structure. There's still you got to make the interest payments, and there's still a lot of there's all sorts of covenants that exist, and and requirements depending on the different credit agreements. There's very few of those those covenants that the companies are required to maintain a certain type of performance. Otherwise, the creditors have a say of what goes on.
There's always a tension between, they call it a technical default, where something, there's some event shifting an asset around or not meeting those covenants that they've installed that allows for the debt holders to collapse on the loan and get control of the assets, which debt holders, they're pretty canny. That's what they're looking to do. The equity holders equally reasonably canny that they're trying to prevent that from happening. So when you have these covenant-like loans, does that create the situation where you have, it's more of a negotiation through the bankruptcy process rather than, previously it would have been settled by, we know pretty clearly what everybody's rights are, and it falls out, whoever's closest to the assets gets control of the assets. Here there seems to be, there's so much debt, there's so much complexity, that does it necessitate a sort of negotiation through that Chapter 11 process? And is that what creates the drama and the tension of something like this?
Well, yeah, I think we have to separate the two different, the barrier is in Chapter 11 and then outside of Chapter 11. And so if we think about what happened in Caesars, the company struggles for several years after the financial crisis. And because they have covenant light debt and the financial markets are actually wide open, there's a lot of refinancings and exchange offers and traditional what's called liability management things to lower the debt to keep the company alive and to save the company and create value for everyone. And this is in fact good for creditors, because some creditors just don't want to foreclose on a troubled business, and they prefer that the current owner is trying to fix it. The flip side is when you cross the line and do things that are so aggressive that those creditors are actually harmed, which I think is the tension that emerges here. And so then there is There's an entire effort to get a restructuring done outside of bankruptcy and Caesars. The advantage of that is that keeps the private equity owners in charge. They can do some kind of comprehensive restructuring or exchange offer that reduces the debt, and everybody takes haircuts, and theoretically, that's the best alternative for everyone. What the story is about, though, is when that fails and you end up in bankruptcy, all the rules change. Suddenly there's a judge who's overseeing the process. The private equity firms don't really have as control anymore. And everyone gets a voice and gets a chance for their grievances to be heard. And it is a very fateful decision to file for bankruptcy because, again, you lose control. And once you give everyone a voice, it's a free-for-all. And that free-for-all is, I think, the basis for the second half of this story.
You don't have some protection. So the debt that they take into the bankruptcy has certain rights for recovery and various other things like that. And the more secured you are, the closer you are to the assets, in my understanding, the better off you were. That if you had unsecured covenant-like debt, you're basically quasi-equity. You're at the back of the pack. You're just going to stand there with everybody else and you're going to get equities gone, probably right. Covenant-like debt. All that subordinated debt is gone. It's really a fight between the guys who've got some security. And if there's residue beyond that, then that's going to cascade down to those other guys.
Yeah, I mean, like, I do.
Well,
yeah,
what's fascinating, in this case is that...
I don't know. I'll touch on just compartmentalizing the covenant issue from the security issue, and covenants ultimately are only going to be something to negotiate pre-petition. It's funny because as soon as a company files for bankruptcy, like the Lev Finn attorneys almost are like, all right, doesn't matter, right? And then it just becomes what is your actual security in your claim? So what do you have liens on? Were those liens perfected? And then do you have other claims? And what those other claims could be these legal claims, because there were assets that were moved away from you pre-petition. Could be fraudulent conveyance, could be, that there's cash that wasn't actually perfected, which means that it was moved too close to the time of the bankruptcy, which is one of the things that happens in this case. And so the different classes of creditors here, we'll break them down between there was the loan group, which is kind of the top, and they had the strongest security and the most protection. They had the first lien bonds, which just slightly below the loan group, but they're both first lien. Then they have the second lien bonds. And after the top two, that was over $10 billion debt, right? And it didn't leave much for the second liens. And so the second liens, they were, essentially part of the plan was to cram them down. And then anything under the second liens is just going to be this giant swath of unsecured creditors that get lumped in together. They would presumably be just even lower than that. And there was a lot of argument and a lot of trying to clarify which creditors had which assets as security, in addition to the fight to pull assets back into the OpCo box that had been moved out of it pre-petition. And so all that was going on, and there's, that's why there's so many fees in bankruptcy. All of these different constituencies get a financial advisor, and they get a legal counsel, I think Sajid could talk about the second lien group, but I would say the most significant group here is that second lien group that contained the Appaloosa and Oaktree, as you know, their two main pugnacious constituents. And one of the most interesting things that happen in this bankruptcy that you'll hardly ever see, and that really kind of it was one of those momentum shifts, was that the second lien group got its own official committee separate from the unsecured creditors committee. The debtor was trying to say, oh, these second lien creditors, they shouldn't even be on the unsecured creditors committee. Like, they're not really part of the, the UCC and the unsecured. It's important to get onto an official committee because then you get all your fees paid by the estate. And ultimately the trustees, appointee that appoints these creditors committee in the bankruptcy process, which is a federal process. He was like, yeah, you're right. You know what? They're not really unsecured creditors. I think they should get their own committee. There should be an official second lien committee. And then the debtor was like, no, I can't. We highly oppose this. And ultimately they did. They prevailed. They got their own committee, which means all their fees were paid by the estate, which really funded a monster who is this amazing attorney who's kind of like born for this type of fight. Sajid, you want to talk about the second lien group in bankruptcy?
What's really interesting, you hit an important point, Tobias, is that the riskiest, the order of risky debt goes from senior to junior. And by that logic, the equity holders should be in the worst possible position. But what the brilliance of Apollo is, and they've done this in so many cases, is that the equity holder, while it's still at the bottom, it controls the company. It controls the management. It controls the restructuring plan. And so even being at the bottom, they can figure out a way to stay in control. And so in the Caesars case, the whole game is that they're going to engineer the restructuring plan. They're going to figure out what the new company looks like, the new capital structure, and they're going to keep an interest by buying the new company's equity. And so they're going to put in a few $100 million to buy Caesars at a cheap value. And that allows them to stay in control, even though, to your point, they should theoretically be wiped out. And they would have been, their original equity would have been wiped out, but in fact, they're going to stay in control by buying the new equity at a cheap valuation, and they can make up for all those previous losses. So in fact, the worst position is not being the equity holder, it's being a junior or unsecured bondholder.
Unless you can get yourself on a committee.
Yes, well, that's helpful. That's the rub, yes.
And then you get your fees paid for, so there's no there's no incentive to negotiate or to stop negotiating at any point. You just keep on pushing for as long as you possibly can, and just become nettlesome, and you finally get your payment to go away.
Right,
it's one strategy.
So what's the Caesars legacy? You say aggressive PE sponsors, asset stripping, priming. What do these things mean?
Those are everything that Apollo got called out for. It's a little bit tongue in cheek, but I think it's also true. Everything that Apollo was really behind a lot of these different the financial engineering prior to the bankruptcy, the asset stripping was when they were, they're moving casinos and different assets away from the operating company that ultimately holds all the debt, and that was the entity that filed for bankruptcy. The priming deals are when you have one group of creditors that they're similarly situated creditors, and you have one group that makes strikes a deal with the company And then all of a sudden they get priority over the other half, that same group. There's a couple of deals kind of like that, that were struck, especially like one particularly egregious one was where 51% of one bondholder, like bond group, struck a deal with Apollo, that essentially got them paid back at 75 cents on the dollar and got the other group almost wiped out. All right. And it was in all these transactions, most of them got called out in the bankruptcy by the independent examiner as being, either subject to potential fraudulent conveyance or corporate governance claims. And eventually Apollo lost their equity check and, their original equity check. So you would think that the lesson would be, don't do those things, but that's not the lesson. That's everyone saw that they did that and how hard it was, it was to fight to by lots of different strokes of luck and skill that the junior creditors were able to get some sort of recovery, how hard that was. And so now the playbook is to do all of those things. You see that like Travelport, Elliott Management, one of the lead first lien of the first lien bond group. In Travelport, they stripped $1 billion worth of assets. That's the IP for this essentially kind of travel payment processing company. Away from their creditors, and then they went into a pair of unrestricted subsidiaries, and then they borrowed money off of that asset, and they're like, we're just going to put $500 million in debt that's now senior to everybody else. So it's asset stripping and priming right there. And then the other creditors are like, no, we're all right, we'll provide that, like, just put them back, like, tighten up our credit agreement. And here's some money. And Elliott got a better deal than they would have had they not been able to do that. Serta Simmons is another one where you had, and these things are, they're taken out of place out of court, where you have, groups of creditors that are clamoring over themselves to provide financing to a company that will become senior to all of the other existing debt. And that took place a lot in 2020.
Gents, we're coming up on time. If folks want to find the book or get in touch with you guys or follow along with what you're doing, what's the best way to go about doing that?
Follow us both on Twitter. I'm just at Max Frumes, M-A-X Frumes. The best place to buy the book that helps with our rankings is on Amazon. Everyone loves that. But it's funny, bookshop.org and Walmart, when the first run kind of sold out quickly, or there was some shipping issue, and Amazon was hit with more orders than they had expected, because it's a highly sought after popular book right now. Bookshop.org and Walmart were the other two, the only other two places that people could get it. Sajid, where do people follow you?
Twitter's a great place. I'm just at Sindap, S-I-N-D-A-P, and of course in the Financial Times.
Gents, it's an absolutely fascinating story. The Caesar's Palace coup by Max Frumes and Sajid Indap. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having us, Tobias. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Tobias. This was great.